We are coming now to toward the end, and I hope you all get my reading done. Several of you have not reading done yet. We are looking at the theories of the origin of the universe, and I'm going to have. I told you that we started out to get our minds in the, back in the groove that any explanation has to deal with what three aspects of the universe?
Size, spin, and energy.
Now there is another aspect which I'm going to get to later, and. But let's finish up what we're going on now. We looked at the nebular hypothesis, the Big Bang theory, and their major aspects and their defects. The continuous generation theory next. The continuous generation theory, off of page 23, is present in several forms. The basic concept is, as the name suggests, that matter is constantly being created in the universe by a not yet identified process. That is, that protons and neutrons and basic elements are simply popping into existence in various places of the universe. We don't know how, but there they are. There are two basic forms of the hypothesis. The theory that matter, number one, is the theory that matter is popping into existence all around us. Somewhere in space, there's an atom created from nothing by a thus far unknown physical process during every instant of time that passes. The universe is big, so you know. Chances are that's happening. If you have enough places where this is taking place, you can theorize a chance creation of the cosmos. This is the skeptic's best suggestion. Is there any evidence of this ever happening?
No.
Proponents of the theory suggest that the process is too diffuse to allow us to detect them. You understand that it's happening because space is so big. Well, it's happening all the time, every moment. Space is so big that the chances of us in our little corner of the universe detecting it are when we happen to, in other words, if it happens, the fact that the chance it would happen to be happening where we happen to be looking, where one of us happens to be looking, is so improbable that it can't happen. Therefore, the argument that we don't have any evidence for it won't hold. I would simply point out that same argument can be used to prove to the same level the existence of ghosties, ghoulies, goblins, and things that go above in the night. That argument, you understand the weakness of that argument. You say, well, there's by some unknown process that's too widely spaced apart for us to detect, matter is being created from nothing spontaneously. Frankly, I'm not religious enough to buy that. Yes?
Is this a steady state theory?
No. The steady state theory?
Yeah.
Well, it could be called a steady state theory. The idea that the universe is not really. Now, the steady state theory simply says all matter is here, it's always been here. This says it's being created spontaneously. The second version of this, there's creation going on at points called eardrums. You got a name for it. As matter is created, it is thrown by so far unknown processes into a radio pattern. And of course, the difficulties of this paradigm are huge. It's really a grasping at straws. The next theory is the quasi-stale theory. This is the steady-state theory. That matter had no beginning, it has always existed. This is Carl Sagan. You know, if you're going to start with if you're going to have something eternal, why not have eternal cloth? Why go to eternal God? I've already talked about this. Now, sometimes, this is called the oscillating universe theory. You see, it's very hard talk about what is the fundamental problem with the quasi-stale theory. Second law of thermodynamics.
It's the disintegrator.
Well, the periodicity of the universe is that whether that the universe now is disintegrating, but it's an oscillating universe, and that when it gets to the end of its disintegrative cycle, it will begin to integrate. And then it will disintegrate again, and integrate, and disintegrate, oscillate. By the way, that's by some unknown process, following some unknown laws. You got that? It's sort of like the spontaneous generation. We don't know how, but it must have. By the way, that's the old argument. Well, the grand argument of the non-theist is it must have. I read it all the time, but it makes me nauseous. It must have. Why? Well, it violates the second law of thermodynamics quite clearly. Then there is the idea of the non-physical origin of the universe, which I hold. Creation by a force or being who stands outside the time-space continuum. God. Not subject to the laws of the three-dimensional universe, not subject to time, fills all of space. I think one of the things you really think about, I have a real problem listening to language. And sometimes, like on the airplane, I get real entertained all the time by the way they say things. I've got to look sometimes when you're on airplanes. I don't do this weekend. Those sitting in the smoking section maybe shouldn't do so. I meant to say was you can start smoking again, not sit back down. That's not what they said. Maybe you heard that from those sitting in this in the smoking, and I heard it this week on a U.S. Air. Those sitting in the smoking section may presume to do so. I had a picture of everybody sitting back down. My favorite is the one that scared me to death. I'm just scared to look up. He said, the plane will be landing shortly. I can't figure out why he went all the way to the runway. Like a plane crash. Landing shortly, then we'll go to the terminal. My favorite is D-plane. D-plane, I guess you have to train your D-train. A D-car in the parking lot. And this class is over in the D-room.
What about when they ask you to get on the airplane?
I'm ready to get in. You're going to jump out of it. Getting back to this language thing, sometimes I have trouble with prayers. And you can't get your hands on prayers are metaphorical, but sometimes you get things in your mind and which are irreverent. It's like, the old Wittenberg, the standard picture of the Last Supper, Vinci's Last Supper, Wittenberg Doris, general statement. Jesus broke the bread and said to his disciples, "Good fellas, if you want to get in the picture, you got to get on this side of the table."
So I never hear that text read until that comes to my mind.
Anyway, one of these statements that bothers me irreverently is, "Father, be with us," as if an omnipotent God could be anywhere else. "Father, we got this section of the universe that you're not going to be in unless we ask you to. So please be here. Quit suppressing your omnipresence and of course, we know what you mean by be with us. Don't they?" Anyway, that's like saying, "Be real. Please exist. Be with us, be here, and be anywhere else." The omnipresent God who fills all of space is with us, whether we ask him to be or not. In that sense. Okay, back to it. It finds support in the work and conclusions of Albert Einstein that time, number one, that time is relative. Time is relative to speed at which the object or person is moving in a finite universe. If Einstein is right, time is relative and the universe is finite, which is exactly what the Bible teaches or suggests.
Explain time is relative in that context.
Time is relative to speed at which an object or person is moving.
time to what we call it 24 hours. It's not 24 hours. It's very relative. It's, you put a watch on the cyclotron and it slows down.
So the theory suggests that if we were to hit the speed of light, if we were to move it, it'd be out of time?
Yes. That's the theory. For instance, and of course, it's implied in the omnipresence of God. If God is not bound by time, then he is, by Einsteinian physics, omnipresent. You want to just say it? Move that out. But if God is not bound by time, he is by, according to Einsteinian physics, he is omnipresent. It all fits together.
Part of the nature of God is really God.
You don't understand that? Let me illustrate this one. See, how long would it take me to get to that nearest tree? At my age, 25 minutes. let's say a minute and a half. Okay. It's going to be old fashioned, I think, in 10 seconds. That's what we got on some kind of missile, I think. That's what we say. We like to travel sometimes so fast. I could eliminate the time between me and that tree. So I could go so fast, I would be here and there sometime. Where would I be? See, I'd be
in basketball for Kentucky.
No, listen to it. You see, I would be, by eliminating the time it would take to get there, I'd become omnipresent. I'm both present at the same time.
But even light travels from point A to point B at this time.
Ultimate speed.
Something faster than that.
Theoretically, I said. Mm-hmm. If I can eliminate the time between us, I'm both places at the same time. But where God is not bound by time, he is omnipresent. Yes?
Would that mean that if we could travel that fast, that we could look back into the past? If we could travel to some place and look back into the past?
You see, Superman's. You know, going backwards in time to save Lois Lane. Theoretically, yes. But you would have to travel faster than the speed of light.
You would have to look back on history and back to
return. But of course, it's not possible because it's theoretical, but mathematically, it's possible.
What happens if you change, like, the fact that you keep it? What happens if you change something back in the past?
We want to explore it. Read Asimov's Time Machine, whatever book he deals with, that from a novel, right?
But would it come out
the same? By the way, by the way, helps us understand how God can be in our past and our present and our future. God is I am, the way Ram was I am. That's staggering, isn't it? Because if God is omnipresent, then he is not bound by time. There is no past, present, or future. It's all one. What do you all think about it? What's going to be involved in our being ageless? And we live in a finite universe. Now, this is the biblical. In other words, the biblical creation is the fifth of man, of course, the non-physical origin. Yeah. You understand that? That's a general categories. Now, let me lay something on you that's not in the syllabus. We're going to revise syllabus. Now, this is pretty deep stuff. This is what you come to college for. There is the one of the remember I said it, the size, spin, and energy. Well, there's another element that theory of the universe has to embrace, and that is what we might call mathematical precision or mathematical coincidence. One of the things that modern physics has uncovered, and which is an area of speculation you don't hear much about, is the fact that in order for the universe to exist as it is,
and for life to exist as it is, there is, in the world of physics and chemistry and biology, an identifiable, quantifiable, calculatable symmetry, precision, mathematical balance that is so delicate that if any tiny fraction of it, any one aspect of several hundred million variables is out, then the whole thing collapses and we do not have a universe as we know it. No. But I appreciate your asking. That is that there is in the universe, there is in the area of physics, chemistry, and biology, there is an identifiable, calculatable, quantifiable balance, precision. Certain numbers become based, appear all through the universe, and when you compute chemical ratios, when you compute, see, our life is carbon based. We are carboniferous. That is, for life to exist, there has to be free carbon. And this is one of many examples. And yet, for the very delicate chemical balance it takes to produce free carbon, and the balance between centrifugal force and, I've already talked about, and gravity, it's infinite. And yet, it is so finely tuned that if any of it goes out, the whole thing falls apart. Now, I just finished reading a book called The Accidental Universe, PCW Davis. And in it, he deals with this. He's not a creationist. He deals with this. And let me read to you from the preface of this book. He explains the phenomenon. In spite of the spectacular progress made by physicists in recent years in understanding the basic forces of nature, many fundamental features of the physical world seem to be arbitrary and meaningless. Why are there three space dimensions? Why is gravity so weak? Why is the protein 1,836 times heavier than the electron? The proton. 1,836 times heavier than an electron. If it were 1,837 times, we wouldn't have a universe. And so on. The numerical values that nature, listen to this language, the numerical values that nature has assigned to the fundamental constants, such as the charge of the electron, the mass of the proton, the Newtonian gravitational constant, may be mysterious, but they are crucially relevant to the structure of the universe that we perceive. As more and more physical systems, from nuclei to galaxies, have become better understood, scientists have begun to realize that many characteristics of these systems, listen to this, are remarkably sensitive to the precise values of the fundamental constants. Had nature, quote, opted for a slightly different set of numbers, the world would be a very different place. Probably we would not be here to see it. More intriguing still, certain crucial structures, such as solar-type stars, depend for their characteristic features on wildly improbable numerical accidents that combine together fundamental constants from distinct branches of physics. And when one goes on to study cosmology, the overall structure and evolution of the universe, incredulity mounts. Recent discoveries about the primeval cosmos oblige us to accept that the expanding universe has been set up in its motion with a cooperation of astonishing precision. Many of these accidents of nature have been known for decades. In 1930s, Eddington and Dirac were struck by the curious and unexpected, listen to this, concurrence of certain very large numbers computed from atomic physics and cosmology, apparently unrelated topics. These and other examples give the impression of a universe that is delicately balanced in a variety of ways. And he goes on, he says,
It is difficult not to be struck by some of the surprisingly fortuitous accidents without which our existence would be impossible. And in this book, he goes through and he catalogs this. It's like, if you want an analogy, we go back to a very complex computer, which is simple. It's like a pencil compared to the complexity of the universe. You take a computer, almost if one thing goes wrong, the whole program goes out. Not very much has to go wrong with the computer. As opposed to an old Model A Ford, an old farm on tractor, it could be half broke down, so you still plow a field. You know? But the new modern ones, at least a little thing goes out and the whole thing falls apart. How did we get this? In other words, we talk about chemistry. The point is what they're finding in chemistry. Talk about how the different base elements came about and how they react and their products as they degrade. And they talk about the physics involved in the motion of the stars and the weight, the atomic weight of that. They find common numbers coming up, which give the universe rhythm and balance and symmetry. And he calls it the axiom of the universe. Listen to this. Now, he goes and he catalogs this in this book. And then he says this. The catalog of extraordinary physical coincidences and apparently accidental cooperation surveyed in the previous two chapters offer compelling evidence that something is, quote, going on. At the beginning of chapter 4, the comment was made that a hidden principle seems to be at work organizing the cosmos in a coherent way. And he goes on. Now, all this prompts the question of why, from the infinite range of possible values that nature could have selected for the fundamental constants, and from the infinite variety of initial conditions that could have characterized the primeval universe, the actual values and conditions conspire to produce the particular range of very special features that we observe. For clearly, the universe is a very special place, exceedingly uniform on a large scale, yet not so precisely uniform that galaxies could not form, and goes on. Now, so what he's done, what he does is he talks about this is a fourth area which must be any explanation of the universe must embrace. This mathematical precision, this delicate balance, without which life could not exist, or the universe could not exist. Now, what explanations are offered for this? Well, there are three basic explanations. One is the explanation of just pure chance. As he says in this book, I like this statement in this particular interview. He says this. He says this. I can't find the phrase. But here it is. He talks about. Here it is. It is one illustration of how, in a universal structure of which is so delicately dependent on the constants of nature, we are exceptionally fortunate to exist. That's the phrase. We are exceptionally fortunate to exist. Our number just came up. Pure chance. Now, however, that view is being pretty much abandoned. Pure chance. Even in biology. to talk about things like certain chemical preferences which produce order, which don't answer at all. But anyway, the second view is called the weak anthropic view. Now, what does the word anthropy suggest to you? Yeah. That somehow this concert, this delicate balance, this mathematical precision, somehow it has to do with man. Well, what to do with man? The weak anthropic view says this. Now, follow me, this is quite complicated. It says that that the view that the universe seems to have a design, seems to be a real plan, is an illusion of man. It goes like this, that you see the universe, and by the way, it does not answer the like all of these theories, it does not deal with the question of the origin of matter. It assumes the existence of matter. But it goes like this. Are you ready? I'm going to explain this the best I can. It's very abstract. The universe is, as we know it, is decaying, at least that which we observe. We only see what we see. Understand? There may be other universes. But we see this one. We see only what we see. We know only what we know. Now, as the universe disintegrates, at certain stages, because of the basic laws of physics and chemistry, it produces certain things, certain stuff, certain elements and certain combinations. You got that? Now, for instance, only at a certain stage can free carbon be produced. So that as the universe goes through stages, then only at a certain point in our universe could life exist. Is it possible for life to exist? As before, life as we know could not exist. Afterwards, life as we know cannot exist. Only at this very small state. So that, really, what we are seeing is that, by the way, this is a tautology, if you recognize the shape of this argument. He doesn't admit that, but it is. It's a tautology. What's a tautology? This is this. What he's saying is that, what this view says, this is weak entropy, which says that that there may be other universes. Understand? And the universe that we see exists, is not the one that was before or the one that shall come. And this universe, the one we see, may have existed in different combinations at other times. So that when we look at and see this marvelous concert, this mathematical concert, this precision, this delicate balance of an infinite number of physical factors and chemical factors and time factors and biological factors that must exist, must all be there in a certain balance, certain arrangement, so that life can exist. Really, what happens is that this particular phase of this universe produced this combination, therefore life was produced,
we observe this particular phase of this universe, and it appears to be purposive, but as a matter of fact, it just happens to be. It really goes back to pure chance, not much difference, except that it simply says that it's an illusion that the universe was designed for man. Did you all get that, sir? So the conditions by chance produced us, and we observe this. Therefore, listen to me. What they're saying and what the Weak Anthropic View says is that what we call order, precision, balance is a quality of the observer, not the observed. Those are some of the conclusions that we have drawn looking at our little phase of our little universe. And that, since we cannot see all of outside this phase, if we could see all of that, then we could see that in the larger sense, there is no concert, there is no balance, there is no rhythm. There just is what is. Therefore, why aren't we here? Because we are here. Why does it look this way? Because that's the way it looks. The totality with no eternal significance. Did y'all get that? Now, the strong, okay, I'll erase that if you got that. The strong view, the third view called the strong entropy, which says that the universe is for man. That there is no other logical explanation for the universe. That is, that there is that life, human life, the observer, the carbonaceous observer is what we are. Human life is all animal life is carbon based. So we are carbonaceous observers. Instead of saying that the carbonaceous observer, man, is simply an accident of one phase of one universe, it says that, this view, strong entropy, says that man is the focus of the universe, but that all of the balance and intricacy and integrated math that we can calculate, quantify and calculate and predict in the universe clearly has no explanation other than being for man. That is, the universe exists so that this world can exist, and this world exists so that man can exist, and man can exist for whatever reason he wants to say. Exist for. Sounds very much like creationism, doesn't it? Like a biblical view, and it is. It's interesting that this view is gaining respectability, strong empathy. That there is no other reason, that the most reasonable explanation is, by the way, this is the argument from design. Go back to that. The argument from design. All it is. The teleological argument. So. Which, by the way, I think is the most rational, we would say, most rational. Which explains why the universe is so big, because you realize the size of the universe is necessary for the balance of our solar system, which is necessary
for the human mind.
Why is the rest of the universe necessary for our solar system to be balanced?
I don't really know all the physics involved, but the experts claim that it is. But it all has to be there, not, I don't know. That the size of the universe was once considered to be extraneous, but that view is dying. It's not extraneous after all. Maybe not the complete size of the type of the universe, because it's extremely delicately balanced. And the factors go beyond our universe. That is, what's becoming clear is that the balance, the symmetry, the function, I guess that's the word I want, of our solar system depends upon the proper function, the distances, the speeds of our galaxy, which depends upon the function of the cosmos. That's kind of like Copernicus, doesn't it? I mean, pre-Copernican theology. And that really is the center of the universe. That is, the case is being made that it all exists so that life can exist here. There's a growing appreciation and awareness of that. Not just in its present position, but in the chemical evolution of the universe. That is why certain elements here. So forth. Quite a concept. Strong empathy. That is the idea that that whole thing, the whole machine, intricate machine, if you want to use that metaphor, the idea that the whole machine could just happen to exist so that in life we just happen to observe it, therefore we attach a significance. In other words, the difference between weak empathy and strong empathy is this. Weak empathy, you says, that man just arbitrarily happens along and is amazed at what he sees and creates a significance, but it's purely subjective. It's basically an illusion. It's simply a human comment on one small phase of one small universe. Therefore, it is an illusion. There's no such thing as this chemical delicate balance. The strong anthropic view says that's ridiculous. That we do not know about the universes. That's a myth. And that it is mathematically, that's what I want to say, it is mathematically absurd, simply in terms of the laws of probability, to say that all that balance, is pure chance. That is, to put it in the language of this author, not his spirit, not his actual word, we are lucky to not have him. We got that, just how lucky is lucky. We can't be that lucky. Nobody can be that lucky. So that human life seems to be the objective of the universe. The strong anthropic view, which is a good that creation would be, is at least it's brought out on this. Any questions on this? It's quite a important little book, because he just listen to what he says. He says if there are other universes, we don't know about them. We do not know how to measure the probabilities between possible universes. It seems like this. You say, well, we happen to be here. What are the chances? What is so amazing about a hole in one? What is golf? Do you know anybody play golf? What is so amazing about a hole in one? Why does everybody go ooh and ah about to make a hole in one? Why does some guys play golf all their life and never hit one?
Well, it's improbable.
It's improbable. Why?
So many factors involved. Yeah.
And how many is going to the preliminary event?
Why? Most of the time they're involved. Well, that's not what I'm getting. The point is that when you hit the ball, there's almost an infinite number of places where you can land, especially back here. I mean, when I used to play golf, the guy standing behind me wasn't safe. I had a hook you wouldn't believe. They used to call me Boomerang. I hit the ball and run for cover myself. Anyway, when I yell four, I always listen. Okay, here's the hole, right? But why is that should be amazing? Is the ball, let's say 50 yards over there, you got a little clump of grass, and the ball could land there. In order to come back here 30 yards of sand track, you take one little corner, it could land there. Why is it more amazing that the ball lands in this hole than in that sand?
That's where you can go.
Yeah, the answer is that there is significance when the ball lands in the hole, which it does not have when it lands on that little clump of grass over there at the sand track. But you see, some suggest, well, how do we know that the ball could have landed anywhere else? That is, that's not what I'm saying. How do we know that this particular universe is any more significant than any other universe that might have existed? How do we know we got a hole in one? That is, we say this is a marvelously designed universe.
How do we know what I'm saying?
But we're talking about the weak entropy. How do we know that this is not simply one of any universes that could have come into existence? And since this one did, it is not any more significant nor probable than any other particular combination, chemical combination, that would have produced another kind of universe. This is what happened to be turned up. Therefore, it is not significant that this universe should exist any more than any other universe should exist, just like in my analogy, it is not more significant if the ball lands over there than over here. Could land in place. Well, the answer is by the nature of the thing. Well, that's all pretty. See how wild we can get. Here's what he says. It's hard to quantify the probability, the improbability of the choice of our perceived world, because although we know how to measure the relative probabilities of, say, heads or tails following the toss of a coin, we do not know how to measure the probabilities between possible universes. Nevertheless, accepting the world ensemble concept, there are many universes, enables one to assert the general fact that our world is indeed extremely unlikely on a priori grounds, and that we are immensely fortunate to exist, even if we cannot precisely assert how fortunate. Well, what we're saying is that mathematically, the strong anthropic view is the only view that will stand up mathematically in terms of probabilities. The probabilities, that is, life seems to be a hole in one. You got that? Human life seems to be a hole in one, not just a clump of grass. It does not seem to be simply one arbitrary universe, possible chemical combination among an infinite number of possibilities. It seems to have, there seems to be teleology, there seems to be purpose, it seems to be a hole in one. Have you all followed this? It's really crazy. I'm thinking, this is the history and logic of science. And I would point out that the creationist view is infinitely the most probable and most noble. That is, you see, this is baloney, and it's being acknowledged as such. This assumes, is a tautology in the first place, and secondly, it assumes too many unknowables. That is, it's amazing how far man will, what kind of universes man will construct in his mind to avoid the God of this one. You know, rather than accept the God of this universe, he will construct a phantasmagorical universes and build his worldviews upon that which might exist. Yes?
The only difference between a strong anthropic
The scientists give their cause for all this design is major or chance and all this.
No, stone entropy view suggests God.
And they
agree. It's meaningless. That's a true condition, was it not? The universe that exists and nobody saw it. The only truly real universe is one that is perceived.
I thought about that before.
And so this universe is obliged to adjust its properties to whatever outrageously improbable arrangement is necessary for conscious beings to arise. That is, in the light of what we know, what it means outrageously improbable, in light of what might be predicted by the second law of thermodynamics, we would have a universe of undimensional chaos, not order, life, balance, and so on.
It's not in creations.
No. But what he's doing, it's a very important book in that he points out that science, good science, because you see, well, let me teach you this, I'll give you a full 10 minutes. The significance of the book is that it's one of many books. I'm going to read another next week. I feel a responsibility to try to keep up with some of the latest. That's what's being said. What he's saying is that only in recent decades have we been able to calculate and appreciate, observe the precision, the balance of the universe. And that as more information becomes available, the simply common sense or, well, I'm going to get technical, the principles of probability are driving men from this down to this, down to the scientific community. Which means we're getting closer to Genesis.
You know, Hoyle kind of came to the same conclusion, but he tried to write it off to extraterrestrial. Yeah. What kind of conclusion does he come to? Is he,
now he just presents the views. He's simply saying this is where, that is, whereas before men, he simply says this at the end. This is code. It might well be that the future developments will provide for some of the numerical coincidences discussed in the foregoing chapter's explanation based on fundamental physics rather than biology than it's based on man. But this is his last statement of the book. Whether the laws of nature can force the coincidences of the universe on the universe or not, the fact that these relations are necessary for our existence, it's a delicate balance, is surely one of the most fascinating discoveries of modern science. That's really his point. But it's significant in that he shows that the movement, the general trend, is in this direction. Because you see, the idea of chance is dying on the hard, the ship of chance is running aground on the hard rock of observed data. You want something more far away. That's the significance of that. Let's take our argument from that.
I'll start lecturing in 1:45.
Okay. Word about, I'm talking about the origin of the universe. I want to say a word about the two theories on the destruction of the universe, it's not your syllabus. I may have mentioned this before, so I'll go to the connection. That if you take the view of the expanded universe, then the question is, what is the ultimate destiny of the universe, unless God steps in, which we know is going to. This is very theoretical. But according to the oscillating, to one version of the oscillating universe theory, the universe will continue to expand until it uses up its velocity, until it reaches a point where the gravitational forces will overcome velocity. The universe is not expanding, it will collapse. In which case, it will then retire.
it will collapse, and it will compress itself into back to the infinite point, and the friction of that final meeting will cause it to explode, perhaps. So whatever. The other view, now most physicists don't, astrophysicists don't hold to the collapse of the guy, that idea. Remember why?
It's being the velocity of the universe is too great to overcome.
Overcome what?
Be overcome by gravity.
No, no collision ever. That's true. Why?
Because they didn't fire that region.
No. The basic problem is none of the mass of the universe. That is, for gravitational force to be sufficient to pull it back together, there has to be a sufficient number amount of material in the universe. And so far, there's not even close, there's not even a large fraction of enough material that's been discovered in the universe, enough mass to overcome the velocity. Even if you put the space dust, there's not enough mass. So the gravitational force is, see, the space is the vacuum, the gravitational force will always be the best. The majority view is that because there's not sufficient mass in the universe, and it's already too far, and what mass there is already too far apart, and traveling at too great a speed, that the that what will happen is that the velocity will overcome the mass. Because there's nothing to stop it. It will expand indefinitely, so that eventually no one point in the universe will be observable from any other point in the universe. It'll be cold, dead, and distant, as opposed to close and hot. Cold, dead, and distant. And keep traveling, eventually, unless the universe is curved, as some suggest, every point in the universe will be an infinite distance from every other point in the universe. And it'll bother. Kind of bothers the mind bothers.
You say cold and distant,
you mean planets? But that's free energy is used up.
The sun's energy is used up.
It's all free energy in the universe is used up before it dissipates. That's just the two views. The majority view is the latter. Understand? Because the computer does not even a large fraction of the mass that according to this kind of calculation would be required to pull it back together. Okay. Last thing we talk about in this course is the mythology of science, where science quits being science and begins to be scientism. Before we get into this, I want to talk to you something before we get into our syllabus.
I want to lay something on you, which is part
speculation on my part, and I want to label it as such. And I'm not sure that this idea will go very far. But I am convinced, well, first of all, let me approach it this way. I'm convinced that we are I'm convinced that perhaps the largest cultural myth in Western civilization is the myth which might in a general sense, general way, be labeled science fiction. We have, for every ounce of science we have in our modern thinking, we have 100 pounds of science fiction.
Labeled as such, man?
No. Not labeled as such. But you all are a product of a culture heavily infused with science fiction. Now, theory of total chance organic evolution is science fiction. I don't care what they say. The improbabilities are so astounding, the evidence is so absent, that it becomes, in my opinion, science fiction. What I'm saying is this, that why is it that the modern mind so totally
the secular mind, the majority mind, so absolutely accepts something that is absolutely, without number one, without evidence, and number two, irrational. Just think about this. Let's just take 10 steps back and think about it. Theory of evolution, amoeba to man evolution, the theory of chemical evolution, is utter nonsense. There's no evidence for it. It is irrational. It is sustained only at the cost of tremendous logical surrender, the surrender of logic. Now, is that a coincidence? Or is it, have you noticed that in the same mind, the modern mind that we can speak of it corporately, that accepts total chance organic evolution, macro evolution, general evolution, also is utterly enamored with science fiction, Star Wars, E.T., Star Trek, close encounters of the third kind, and so on. And such that the average kid today, in the world in which you grew up in, accepts that stuff, not as true, but it is accepted as plausible. And our modern space program is heavily infected with science fiction. We saw this when they kept the men in quarantine. The first two moonshots that kept the men in quarantine when they came back. I could have saved them a lot of money. The idea that this life is just popping into existence, it's bound to be on the moon. And of course they quit that nonsense. They were seriously looking for some kind of life on Mars, but Mars has an oxidizing surface, that is, where free oxygen is present, the spontaneous generation cannot take place. Well, anyway, as I think I may have mentioned before in here, all this talk about this Challenger 7 killed, Challenger exploded. Everybody agreed that, we got to go on, Mark. This is the first step to the day when we shall walk on the star, visit the star, shall visit other solar systems. We've got to start somewhere, and we cannot stop now. This is science fiction. You understand that? It's science fiction. So, now, but I got another point I want to make. But let me, Hoyle deals with this. Hoyle is a guy you should know. He talks about, and I've talked about this before, the possibilities of interplanetary space travel, which is the basis of ET and
interplanetary
space travel. Listen to what he says. Space travel in general. Nope. We got to the moon. Is that space travel? Yeah? Yeah. It's not going very far. Now, let me share it with you. You don't mind. If I sit down, do you? This is a statement of Hoyle. I guess it's very significant. The truth, you talk about deep space travel, the seemingly insuperable difficulties of deep space travel suggest an intention to keep us fixed at home in our own solar system. Whoever uses it, whatever this intelligence is, it seems to want to keep us here on Earth, in our own solar system. And the physical nature of our part of the universe, as well as the basic rules of physics and chemistry, have a warning look about them, like barriers designed to isolate intelligent life. That means that for us, unlike the situation for humble microorganisms, travel through space, he said. Deep space travel is probably a stark impossibility. Only in the fairy tale world of space warps and the like can there be travel on an interstellar scale. That means one solar system. And although these fairy tale concepts, And although these fairy tale concepts have been accepted by the public,
to a considerable extent by being commonplace in science fiction. No amount of entertaining stories or snappy jargon can make them plausible. It's not plausible. The truth rests, I'll let this say, the truth rests with Sir Richard Woolley, a former astronomer royal, who brusquely announced, quote, space travel is bunk, to the delight of the media, which specialize in catching the fish that swims against the popular tide. Now, it's interesting, it's alarming to me how many people at NASA honestly believe in the possibility of space travel. I'm just spelling it, deep space travel. What is the space barrier? Well, are you interested in wine?
Are you talking space, are you talking before you get into
out of our solar system? Okay.
We know we can throw
our solar system very local. And we know enough about our solar system to know there's any place that we want to go. Yes.
Now, the universe is expanding, right? It seems to be expanding. Is there anything that's traveling in the same direction we are? And if there is, could a vehicle leave our planet in this way?
No, because the vehicle would be traveling at whatever speed it was shot off at, plus the speed of our planet, in relation to the other planet.
That would stop it from going to another planet.
Can't do it. Can't get out of that way. Besides, the way would be too long. Even if you
distance?
Could.
There's that much distance.
Yes. Listen to this. He's talking about the possibility of going to one of the nearby solar systems. Space enthusiast, he says this. The colonization of the galaxy is conceived of by those who take it seriously in a manner remarkably similar to the method used by the Phoenician crew 600 BC at the end of the world. Although estimates are rather uncertain. Extrapolate the nearest star system to ours, containing such a body, that is where we can land and colonize. Land and live. Chances are the nearest would be 100 light years away. The nearest possible. Extrapolating present day technology enormously. I got this. So just figure there would be some place you could land. Assuming you could build a spacecraft to sustain life, and assuming you could be interviewed off the Earth. The nearest star system to ours containing such a body would then be about 100 light years away. Extrapolating present day technology enormously. I'm taking the present day technology extrapolating. To the limit of what knowledge, to what a knowledge of physics shows to be possible, it has been calculated that a spaceship might conceivably travel at 1/10 the speed of light. In other words, if you just remove all the barriers and really get fanciful, extrapolate our present technology to the limits of the laws of physics, what we know, you might get a spaceship up to 1/10 the speed of light. Now, nobody knows how, but that's really being generous. In which case, a ship from Earth would reach the nearest suitable star system in a mere 1,000 years. On arrival, the plan calls for the crew to land and establish a colony, which expands and takes over the new planet or satellite. This is Star Trek. After waiting a suitable period for consolidation, which may be several thousand years, even 100,000 years, the process started at Earth would be repeated. But with an important difference, instead of a single spaceship being sent out from the new planet, two ships are dispatched. The two ships are targeted next to near star systems, with colonizable bodies, which they reach in a few thousand years. Further colonies are then established, if need be, at quite leisurely rate. Each of these colonies eventually sends out two ships, and the process is repeated so that by the 10th generation, there are 512 ships. The land sends out two, the land sends out two. And by the 20th generation, a fleet of over 500,000, and so on. Such a rapidly growing cascade of ships
could seep its way through the entire galaxy in a few million years. Which, from the point of view of a major biological development, is entirely acceptable in a whole time. So what is to stop this from happening? Does the fact that they, some other creatures are not here, really disprove the picture of life of a cosmic phenomenon? Not at all, in my view. Of course, I see the arguments flat in your own considering achievements today of human space technology. Its suppositions are highly presumptuous. After 2 decades of space flight, the climax of a vast effort by the world's strongest economy, America, has been to expel from the solar system a handful of tiny vehicles, tiny compared to what would be needed by colonists, and expel only at a tiny speed. Listen to this, 10,000 times less than the speed assumed in the argument. Sorry, the colonizing. Best speeds to which they were second in are 10,000 times less than the speed assumed in the argument, which is 1/10 the speed of light. I think it's like that. No. This is not what it is. It's what you're saying is 10,000 times less than the speed of light, that's what it is. The gulf between actual attainment, even at enormous expense, and what would be needed is so great that there is no certainty it'd never be crossed, even if technology were improved to the limit of physical possibility. By the way, I'm saying that for instance, if you could build theoretically by the laws of physics, if you could, by applying the known laws of physics, if you could build a spaceship big enough that would get there to the nearest solar system at the speed of 1/10 the speed of light, boost it to that speed, assuming people could live long enough to get there, if they can, it would take more energy to put the spaceship there than exists on Earth. More usable energy. There's no need. The perspective.
No.
Yes.
Now, what's the term that is worth? So once we get out of the gravitational Earth, does it get less energy to keep holding?
The problem is getting out of the gravitational pull of Earth. And that's boosting those speeds. Boosting those speeds after it's out of that gravitational
pull. Once it's at that speed, the gravitational pull just continues.
But just getting into that speed. You know how much energy, for instance, look at this, the space shuttle. That's tiny. In other words, it would be like putting, it would require the power probably to put the entire ship in. What kind of ship, the weight of the ship, it would be impossible. It would sustain a lot of the travel. That's why, because of the distances, that's why, listen, science fiction overcomes the science fiction does by the concept of space warps. Or hyperspace, where you first are stargates, whatever. Where you push a button and all of a sudden you overcome distance. There's an Asimov, and this is Star Trek. Warp speed is in Star Trek. Mr. Zulu gives us warp speed. All of a sudden you disappear and you appear. And or in Star in in Asimov, what is that?
Star Wars too.
Yeah. In Asimov's books, it's hyperspace. But that doesn't exist. You see, that's a fiction about overcoming distances. Another way in which
Star Trek isn't because of some fuel that they found, and they actually go to the speed necessary to break the speed of light.
To break the space barrier.
Because warp speed and the writing of Star Trek is warp speed again. Now look at Chris's warp speed one is the speed of light, and so what they're doing is theoretically dilithium crystal or something can be found to be used in power, then it seemed like that would overcome.
But it assumed that you can enter as a warp in space, you can enter here and come out here and not be stuck with the distance in between. Which doesn't exist. Can't overcome distance.
They don't go through they create a warp by the theory you talked about earlier, that if you could go faster than the speed of light, then distance time would not exist.
It's like a real objection.
Yeah. But you cannot go much greater scale. The idea of really at speed, of course, is
Anyway, and they overcome it by having people going into the, they go into comas, or, you know, they self-induce coma, they put in a search rate, and they respond this long time. Anyway, space travel would be, are you interested in this? Space travel enthusiasts would accuse me, I suppose, of a narrow lack of imagination. Consider our distant ancestors a million years ago. Could they have conceived of the modern airplane, might be asked, or of modern radio communication, which is normally here? What about our ancestors? They would have been able to impossible. So why not extrapolate the wonder between the Mesopotamian, you know, dirt slave and the modern space technologist, and you extrapolate that wonder on, well, that's impossible. Extrapolate possibilities. This is modern science fiction thinking. Of course not, but while such apparent miracles of achievement are possible in matters that are initially beyond our comprehension, miracles of achievement are much harder to come by in matters we already know a lot about. The difference is they didn't know anything about this. We know about space travel. The ancient Mesopotamians didn't know about rocket propulsion, electricity, but we know about space travel, is what you're saying. Our ancestors of a million years ago knew a lot about sticks and stones, and I doubt that we today could do much better or even equal them in stick and stone technology. The essential point is that nothing discovered in the future can contradict what we already know to be true. And future miracles in known areas of knowledge that cannot be expected to appear in order, like space wars. The real riposte is to the colonization argument, however, is that the whole of the picture conceals the important assumption that the spaceships were always targeted and even towards the next port of call. It sounds simple, but how can this be done? How can we know in advance which of the nearest thousand star systems contain the next one planet or satellite of the planet? Anybody who's observed a telescope two approximately equal stars that are close together knows that it becomes impossible to distinguish them separately when they are too close together. When the angle between the stars is less than a certain amount, about one part of 3,000th degree, one part of 3,000th degree, it appears as a combined blur. You know, they're not all we think are stars, they're really galaxies, or several stars. That large telescopes are no better for this purpose, and so forth. He goes on to say, you cannot target spaceships. So if spaceships cannot be targeted directly, what happens if the nearest thousand star system has to be searched individually? Get out there and look around for more colonize. At first sight, one might think the penalty would simply be a longer search, with the path of a ship zigzagging between the stars, extending the journey between 10 and 100 fold, making the time involved in each step a search of 100,000 years instead of the previous 1,000 years. Being cooped up in a spaceship for 100,000 years would certainly not be an attractive proposition. It would not in itself make the journey a complete impossibility. The possibility, however, comes, however, with the question of how a spaceship could manage to zigzag from one star to another. If the ship traveled at great speed, say at 1/10 out of light, the change in momentum at each zig and each zag is very large, demanding an enormous amount of power. And for 1,000 changes in direction, this would manage to become preposterous. He talks about, well, if you can bounce and you grab your planet like that, our spaceships do slingshot, so that would take so long. He said, if the search time, if you use this method, the search time for finding even one suitable planet, then jumps, if you use the balance like you know, use the gravity or zigzags or slingshots, you change your course. If you're going to do that method, the search time for finding even one suitable planet, then jumps from 100,000 years to 100 million years. And for intelligent creatures being cooped up inside a ship for 100 million years, I'm going to agree with that. Really justifies the term impossible. Since finding all suitable planets would take 1,000 times longer still, the entire colonization of the galaxy would require 100 billion years, which is much longer than the whole history of the galaxy. Truly a total impossibility. These difficulties are so straightforward that I often used to wonder why the idea of colonizing the galaxies is discussed so often. Why is it not going to the waste of the vast? And you realize that most people in America think that that's going to happen. This came out in chapter 7 of the book. It's a matter of time. Can you stop at the present technology? Give enough time? That's got to happen. It's humanistic nonsense. It's got to happen. Why? We're in the destiny of the stars, inner dreamers.
vessel for the toilet. The reason I think, this is this. The reason I think lying, why do people still just talk about it? We know so much about it. The reason I think lies in the notion that the development of technology, anything, listen to me, here is modern mythology of science. This is it. And here's the science exposing it. This is this. The reason I think lies in the notion that with the development of technology, anything at all might be possible. Again, such an immovable position is necessary, against such an immovable position, it is necessary to answer with an irresistible force. Colonization of the galaxy is impossible because it is deliberately arranged to be so.
So then NASA should close up and make kinds of minions.
Well, not necessarily that. I think there are advantages to the space program. But what I'm saying is that the idea of space, deep space travel, simply is a part of the modern science fiction mythology.
Well, you begin to wonder after the last two things they tried to put up.
You wonder if somebody is trying to keep us here. But
this same argument then forego any possibility of intelligent life coming to Earth from other places?
Yes.
ET or post-Atlantic?
Not intelligent life. He says microorganisms can travel into space, but not
intelligent life.
You see, let me give you an analogy to this modern man that we're eventually going to get to the fire, to the deep stars, and the man is destined for the stars and all that nonsense. It's extrapolation. It's the same thing with evolution, the same kind of mindless extrapolation. That's like saying that if a little boy can throw a marble 10 feet, and a man can throw a baseball up 200 feet, therefore, by simply exerting more forcible energy, I should be able to throw this building around the world. No, there's a limit, you see. You can establish a little boy with a marble or a man with a baseball. A little boy can throw a marble, a 10-year-old boy can throw a baseball. But eventually, just because, you understand, just because a 10-year-old can throw it three times farther than a 5-year-old, doesn't mean a 50-year-old can throw it 20, 30 times more than a 10-year-old. He just breaks down. And so we look at the theory of evolution. I hope I haven't. I haven't meant to be, snobby about this, but evolution is science fiction. What it is. And it's a part of a larger science fiction, which is expressed in this modern belief. It's everywhere. You guys know that. Where the man eventually going to travel in space. But here's Hoyle, who's one of the leading world's leading astrophysicists, who says that space travel is bunk. The experts know space travel is bunk. Under the present law, we know too much about it. The law, the distances are too great, the amount of energy required, just simply cannot do it. We aren't going to do it. Now, but why does everybody think that we will? Why has it become plausible? Well, maybe, and I think the science fiction motif today is a part of, I think it's a part of the satanic scheme. Not sound spooky to say that. But it's interesting that Satan has always done that kind of thing. The idea that elevating man above the man is put aware on earth, saying to man that his destiny somehow is tied to the star, to turn man's eyes to the heavens in an untoward way. For instance, look at astrology. What is astrology? The idea of the stars and the devils. Look at oneness, nice, which is occult, which is clearly the direct product of the satanic mind. What's the story of oneness? There was Jesus and his brother on the planet Yeah, and they all came to Earth, interplanetary travel to Earth, and eventually we'll all travel to the far distant. We'll colonize.
Yeah, but we'll each have our own
planet. Each have our own planet if we're good, Mormons. In other words, that Jesus came to Earth, interplanetary to travel. It's all a part of the same scheme. And listen to me, what it does, again, this is my speculation. I think that the whole modern science fiction myth, Western civilization, whether it's expressed in the textbook evolution or science fiction theaters
or in Mormonism, or in astrology, or in the space program, the illegitimate dreams of the space program, and untoward unjustified extrapolations. I think what it does, it elevates man. It says to man that you are the master of the universe, and it obscures God. It makes man bigger than he is, and it makes God absent. I think one of the most deadly ideas that I got into the force is Star Wars. Grabs, who decides? Man decides. The role of man is God. That's the whole thing. It's the old beginning. Let me summarize it this way. This modern mythology of science fiction, in whatever shape it takes, is the old beginning temptation of looking like to be God. It's the invitation to be God. The God of the universe. And very, very subtle. I think the subtlety is one that the cultural myth. This is worse. The modern cultural myth of the unlimited possibilities of human of a man in space, that cultural myth is more ignorant and superstitious than the view that somehow in the Middle Ages of a flat earth. I mean, you can make a better case for a flat earth than you can for a man in space. And deep space.
What has been the reaction? What has been the reaction to scientific community? Just interesting to see what the true science.
He's not the only one.
Oh yeah, no, I just wondered what is this the general swing of things? Is this
swing is away from? It's not away from science fiction to creation. It's away from one form of science fiction to another one. Panspermia and pantheism and this kind of thing. We're heading back to that one. Back to Ishtar and Marduk and all that.
What's the great purposes of the space program? I've never had any great.
Well, there has been a lot of serendipity, a lot of collateral technology which has come out of. A lot of materials. That's been very good in many ways.
Well, satellites,
satellites, for instance, for communications, and a lot of plastics and medicine, various materials. I think it's been some real positive things.
These drugs can't be
Well, that's a good point. For instance, you take a trip to the moon. Hugely expensive, a trip to the moon. Absolutely useless. We brought back some rocks, which frankly haven't helped a whole lot of people. Haven't been in, curiosity.
The aspect that we now know?
Well, let me tell you this. What it has done,
or is it
technological curiosity? We gained nothing from that. We didn't gain from this company orbits as far as space technology. But we gained nothing. We found we can do it. I'm not saying we shouldn't go. I'm as thrilled as anybody else. That was great. But what it did, the main product of the moonshots was human pride. That was the primary product. It produced nothing in technology that could not have been produced just in like the space shuttle or the satellite bubble. And it did make us all bit proud. They got some rocks out of it. But I don't know if they got all that much more out of it, Frank.
Or was it not motivated by
What we did, they got the rocks, what we did. But I think there is, don't misunderstand, I think there is some value. Some of them are being forced into it. Of course, I wouldn't want the Russians to control space. But what I'm saying is, compared, we send in the moon, which I was greatly impressed. I thought it was tremendous. I love it. I was proud of it. But to extrapolate that to space travel, deep space, is really silly. The moon is doing well, but that was a local trip. idea how low. For instance, what, take 3 or 4 days to get there? What do they call them? You recall now that the unmanned spaceships, which are going to be out of into our solar system, were shot off several years ago. And just now getting to the edge of our solar system. Boy,
what's between our solar system and us? Just new space.
I'm a student who pays attention. Well, if I've been too vague, you get my point. I think it's a part of this message which we're approaching the mythology of science, that science has become a superstition. This is superstitious nonsense. And as a matter of fact, I mentioned this in our church when I was part of the sermon. I came in, I mentioned the space travel is above. Somebody doesn't know how to use space travel. I don't know. He tells me no to religious exception. He said, I utterly believe that we're going to find a whole new technology somewhere. And I said to him, well, this technology better be a real dinner. It's got to overcome the laws of space and time.
All the great steps we made in technology. Somebody could say, 200 years ago, somebody thought about atomic power and it was going crazy. That overcomes problems. Atomic power overcomes problems that we have on Earth. Atomic power does not touch anything like that, so it would be.
The two main problems of space travel is you realize that the tremendous power it takes to lift something out of space into orbit is enormous. You wonder why the shuttle looks so small? Except on that huge fuel tank, the tremendous amount of energy and force it takes to get that. See, with this, you can put a Volkswagen in orbit, that's not a configuration orbit, as long as you have enough capacity to keep in the speed. You have to get enough speed to get in orbit. That's what held it back for a long time. That's why the Russian Sputnik was a big thing. They didn't have the space, they didn't have the rocket fuels that would have enough boost to get it up to a sufficient speed. We could have shot around the world at a certain speed, but we couldn't get it in orbit because we didn't have a certain speed. No matter what it is. Understand? Oh, you think it can be a basketball or a skyscraper, it has to go set a certain speed. Now the other thing is, so the power it takes to get that kind of speed is one factor. The other is simply the distance. Just so far. And who's going to live? There was 5,000 of these. They build a spaceship, look at the thing in orbit, go to their solar system, and I went. Think how big it would have to be to sustain my life, the life of my children, my grandchildren, my great grandchildren. Suppose I got them out there and got a great grandchild, and didn't want
to
go. Yeah, I think the idea is something preposterous. As Hoyle said, we know too much. Well, I think this is very fun to do. What did I look on this? I've got to look out on the modern space, on the modern science fiction, how it affects us. What it does, it expands. I think the primary goal, I say, is to puff up man. Tell me, you're a fella. You're God. You're as much God as there is a God. There is a God, you're it. Mark, I'll let you have it with the stipulation that you check it in. Tell my lab teacher to turn back to the piece of technology.
Mostly non-creation sources. Are you going to count all the rockets in your own set?
Well, depends on the nature of the rockets.
I can understand you.
Well, do the best you can. How's that for a dollar? How's that for a dollar?
You know, I read one time, they said
dollar? All that verse,
they come back and said, calculate.
They do.
I know that one. I've heard it.
This kind of piece, all the universe, or piece of rock.
I guess I'm going to speak to the why, and that's why it was shook me a lot. But, no, I've read a lot of science fiction where they say, they build some kind of ship outside the orbit, and they find some kind of propulsion. I can